From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, South Korea's president calls for a unified Korean peninsula. NATO confident in Afghan security following political power sharing. U.S. military concludes a massive drill in Western Pacific. These stories and more on this Friday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. In her address to the 69th Annual United Nations General Assembly session Wednesday, South Korean President Park Geun-hye noted the 25th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall and urged the international community to eliminate the last Cold War frontier between the two Koreas. Ms. Park lamented this wall of division brought about by the 1953 armistice ending the Korean War has separated families who have spent decades in agony longing to see their loved ones. The South Korean leader renewed her call for building corridors to connect the environment, livelihoods, and cultures of the two Koreas and an end to the 4-kilometer-wide and 250-kilometer-long demilitarized zone, or DMZ. She said a unified Korea will be a starting point for a world without nuclear weapons, offer a solution to the human rights issue on the peninsula, and unlock a stable and cooperative Northeast Asia. RAND Corporation Korea analyst Bruce Bennett told VOA's Victor Beatty Ms. Park's address has received only spotty coverage in South Korea.
There are very different descriptions between different papers, even in Korea. Some focusing on the energy recommendations and others on the inter-Korean issues. So, I mean, she has very good issues that she's touching on, but I think she didn't quite catch people's attention on the key issues with regard to the North.
What do you make of the equivalency between what Ronald Reagan said during his presidency about the Berlin Wall in the 1980s with what she said yesterday?
The challenge in both cases was the serious wall that divided things. I think we were much luckier in Europe that conditions developed in the not-too-far time out from when Reagan made his speech that something was able to be done. It's really hard to tell whether or not similar situation will develop in Korea. It could well, but we just don't know for sure.
She talked about the environmental, economic benefits of a unified Korean peninsula. Obviously, this is not something that's going to fly in Pyongyang.
Oh, heavens no. Her whole approach in the speech suggested more unification by absorption than the kind of track that North Korea would agree to, yes.
Well, there's absolutely no difference, is there, between the Koreas and the divided Germany?
In this case, probably a much poorer North Korea and a much more heavily indoctrinated North Korea, which suggests, given as much difficulty as the Germans actually had, the need for better preparation in Korea. And President Park is working on that with her Committee on Unification. But it's a very difficult task, and they certainly need some new ideas.
Were her remarks directed toward China?
Well, I think in part they were. I mean, because she'd made comments about how refugees from North Korea ought to be allowed to stay where they're trying to go and be treated as real refugees, which China doesn't allow. She didn't mention China in specifically, but she clearly was making the point. And I think more generally, China is going to have to be involved if almost any of the kind of things she says relative to North Korea are going to develop.
The South Korean leader also tried to convey a sense of urgency about resolving the North Korean nuclear issue, which she says represents the single greatest threat to peace on the Korean Peninsula and in Northeast Asia. She also called for a Northeast Asia Peace and Cooperation Initiative aimed at building an order of trust and cooperation to grapple with climate change, nuclear safety, disaster relief, and transnational crime. NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen says he is confident that Afghan forces can take charge of security behind a new government in Kabul that comes as part of a political power-sharing agreement following this year's historic elections. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns reports from the United Nations, where the NATO Secretary General spoke with VOA about Afghanistan, Syria, and Ukraine.
Mr. Rasmussen welcomed the power-sharing arrangement between Afghanistan's new president, Ashraf Ghani, and its new chief executive, Abdullah Abdullah, saying NATO looks forward to the quick signing of agreements to permit the deployment of an alliance-led training mission in January 2015. That will replace the NATO-led International Security Force that's been in Afghanistan since 2001. With that change, Mr. Rasmussen told VOA that he believes Afghan forces are up to the challenge of Taliban fighters who oppose the new government.
I'm confident that the Afghan security forces can take full responsibility for the security in Afghanistan by the end of this year as planned. They have been in the lead of security operations during the last year, and they have handled also difficult security situations quite professionally.
Mr. Rasmussen says NATO has no formal role in the coalition that's striking Islamic State forces in Iraq and Syria, but is ready to resume its training mission in Iraq if the new government in Baghdad asks.
We have also decided to strengthen exchange of intelligence and information to counter the risk and threats from foreign fighters returning to our home countries.
Mr. Rasmussen says Russia's invasion of Ukraine was a blatant breach of international law that will forever change how NATO approaches Moscow.
After the end of the Cold War, we had an historic chance to create something new in Europe, a Europe whole, free and at peace. And to that end, we also need cooperation with Russia. However, today we have to realize that Russia doesn't consider us a partner but an adversary, and we'll have to adapt to that.
Mr. Rasmussen ends his five-year term as NATO chief later this month. He'll be replaced by the former Norwegian Prime Minister Jens Stoltenberg. Scott Stearns, VOA News at the United Nations.
Ways to reduce the leading cause of death in Bangladesh are being floated in schools. That's coming up on Daybreak Asia. The U.S. military has conducted a major joint exercise in Western Pacific waters. The exercise comes amid rising concern about encounters involving China and other countries in disputed waters of the East and South China Sea, as well as airstrikes against Islamic militants in Syria. We have more from VOA correspondent Steve Herman in our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
As the U.S. military prepared for an airstrike on Syria, more than 18,000 personnel from the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps wrapped up participation in the U.S. military's largest joint exercise, a 9-day drill held in the Western Pacific. Named Valiant Shield 2014, it also included two nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, 19 surface ships, an undisclosed number of submarines, and more than 200 aircraft. Cruisers at sea fired missiles, adding a realistic element to the air-sea battle concept, which aims to overcome enemy attempts to deny access and maneuverability within sea lanes and airspace. Both China and Iran, in their recent military doctrines, have emphasized such strategies. The operational commander of the exercise, Navy Rear Admiral Mark Montgomery, says conducting a combined drill primarily at sea is more challenging than one on land, because of reliance on long-range communications. But he says the command and control element held together tightly. Speaking to VOA News from the USS George Washington aircraft carrier, the commander explained this latest Valiant Shield exercise included new elements.
We tested new tactics, techniques, and procedures for long-range engagements or for search and detection of adversary combatants that proved successful.
Montgomery, who is commander of Battle Force 7th Fleet, also confirms there was a significant cyber component to the war game.
This is my third Valiant Shield, the first one where I've seen this kind of cyber play. And I think it's indicative of the fact that this is a growing domain for us, particularly something that we have to ensure that our defenses are properly aligned, and one where you have to integrate the effects we're achieving on the offensive side.
A Chinese auxiliary spy ship was nearby in the U.S. exclusive economic zone while the exercise was underway off the Pacific island of Guam. The commander notes that did not come as a big surprise.
We had no problem with it. In my mind, all the operations were safe and professional between the ships, but clearly it was here to observe, monitor, and collect on a U.S. training event.
China's territorial claims, which conflict with other countries in the East and South China Seas, have led to increased tensions in the region. The United States is bound by treaties to defend two of those claimants, Japan and the Philippines, if they are attacked. The U.S. Defense Department says a Chinese fighter jet came within 6 meters of an American Navy plane last month, about 215 kilometers east of China's southern Hainan Island. China's naval commander has vowed to continue intercepting such U.S. military aircraft conducting close-in surveillance. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
China's sentencing of Uyghur scholar Ilham Todi to life in prison this week has triggered a wave of criticism, both from rights activists in the country and from foreign governments and advocacy groups overseas. In response, China's state media have begun hitting back, writing scathing accounts of Todi's alleged crimes and telling foreign governments and rights groups to mind their own business. VOA's Bill Ide has more from Beijing.
In its account of the trial released Thursday, China's Xinhua news agency says court documents show the former economics professor mesmerized his students, preached violence, and promoted separatism. It also says the court found him guilty of organizing a criminal group to promote independence and sow discontent among China's ethnic groups. Xinhua said more than 200 pieces of evidence were presented to the court during the trial, including video footage of Todi allegedly calling on his students to fight the Chinese government and calling China's ruling authorities a devil to the Uyghur people. Xinhua did note that Todi denied all of the charges against him and argued that he did not intend to split the country. Todi told the court that the articles that were printed on his website, Uyghur Online, were merely academic points of view, Xinhua added. Todi's lawyers say that he has already signed his appeal and that the details of that 15-page document will soon be released online. Todi denies all of the charges that have been brought against him. One of his lawyers, Liu Xiaoyuan, says the evidence disclosed in court is insufficient to convict Todi of the crimes he stands accused of committing. He also adds that there are contradictions in the court's accusations as well. Liu says the students who worked on Todi's Uyghur Online did not confess to any crimes. They only admitted that they had worked together with the professor to run the website. Liu says several of the students only began working on the website a couple of years ago, but the public prosecutors have accused them of creating a separatist criminal group in 2006, and that some 50 to 60 individuals were part of the group. He says that while 8 of his students were taken into custody, it was only Ilham Todi facing charges in court. According to Xinhua, the court revealed that Todi told his students in the classroom, "Don't think that fighting with violence is terrorism." The report did not elaborate about the context of the remarks and what Todi might have meant by the comment, leaving wide room for interpretation. In interviews with VOA, Todi has made similar remarks, but when he did, he was referring to just how difficult it is in China to tell whether incidents in Xinjiang or the attack in Beijing late last year are acts of terrorism or local disputes. When violent incidents occur, Chinese authorities release very little information. Xinhua, in many cases, is the only news agency allowed to report on sensitive news stories, such as the attack on Tiananmen Square last October. Liu says Todi's case is really about freedom of speech, and what he said in the classroom were published on his website. Liu says the situation in Xinjiang now is very tense, and that's why some of the details of the case are so unrealistic. State media have also been incensed by comments some have made online comparing Ilham Todi to South Africa's Nelson Mandela. Both the United States and European Union have condemned the ruling and called for Todi's immediate release. And China's state media have responded in kind, urging foreign governments to stay out of the country's internal affairs. An opinion piece in the Communist Party-backed Global Times called such efforts to sway China's courts futile, arguing that a criminal is a criminal. The article noted that dissidents in China should realize just how little the West can do to intervene. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
Hear more on the Todi sentencing and reaction later today on VOA's China Focus. In Bangladesh, the largest cause of death of children above age 1 is not malnutrition or disease. It's drowning. To combat this threat, a local nonprofit organization is teaching thousands of children to swim. Amy Yee reports from Dhaka.
It's a hot afternoon and a group of 12-year-olds in this park are learning to swim as the call to prayer floats over the city. An above-ground inflatable swimming pool in a park is an unusual sight in Dhaka, but each week, dozens of children take swimming lessons here. A swim teacher is chest-deep in the pool with kids in T-shirts and blue swim caps. The free lessons are offered through the nonprofit Center for Injury Prevention and Research Bangladesh. From 2006 to 2013, local swim instructors have taught about 360,000 children to swim, mostly in villages where the majority of people live. It's a life-saving mission. An estimated 18,000 children drown each year in Bangladesh, making drowning the largest killer of children aged 1 to 18. Dr. Aminor Rahman, director of the International Drowning Research Center in Dhaka, recalls one tragedy in a village when a boy tried rescuing his 5-year-old brother in a pond.
The villagers actually tried to search the child, and unfortunately, both of them were dead. And it was assumed that they went to the pond for washing hands and feet, and maybe someone, maybe the younger one, may have fallen down in the pond. So it's a very pity that both child drowned.
Bangladesh sits on one of the world's largest river deltas above the Bay of Bengal. It is a country full of rivers and ponds. Dr. Rahman says people often do not think of water as a threat because it is literally in their backyards.
Somebody says we used to swim here. We go for bathing, washing everything, nothing happened. And sometimes they often say that it's God's will, we cannot protect. If the luck is that he will drown, nothing to do with that. This kind of misperception actually exists in the community.
Most drowning deaths happen when unsupervised children fall into ponds near their homes. 75% of drownings happened within 20 meters of home. In recent decades, Bangladesh has improved child health so that deaths from diarrhea and pneumonia, which are the two largest killers of children in many developing countries, have dramatically declined. However, over the same period, there was no reduction in drowning deaths. Most victims are from poor, uneducated families in rural areas. Rural children toddle about on their own around fields, roads, and ponds. For children above 5 years old, learning to swim is one way to prevent drowning. The center has trained 2,700 local swimming instructors according to international guidelines. It seems to be making a difference. In 3 years of the program, drownings among children between 5 and 9 dropped 48%, according to a paper in the U.S. journal Pediatrics. Amy Yi, VOA News, Dhaka.
Weddings are one of life's major events, and wedding pictures are a key part of it for the memories they provide. Daybreak Asia's Ray Kugel tells us about a mini documentary that shows how they're undergoing a big transition in China.
In China, taking wedding photographs is almost as important as the wedding ceremony and celebration. But that age-old tradition is now facing a significant change. The 80s generation, with its economic success, is finding another way. And a short branding film called Kitty and Lala shows quite a different picture, literally. Kitty and Lala are wedding photographers whose sense of style and imagination are taking the business to a new creative level. Based in Hangzhou, the pair, in their late 20s, uses location shooting and inventive backgrounds, often combined with colorful costumes, to provide vibrant pictures for a new young generation in China with money to spend.
Because
The photo blog for their company, called 80 Impression, is one of the most popular in China. The film Kitty and Lala is part of Intel's Visual Life campaign, which produces video portraits of creative people around the world. Kitty and Lala is directed by 28-year-old Cho Lee, born in Shandong and raised in Melbourne, Australia, where he is currently based. I spoke with Lee about the transformation surrounding wedding pictures in today's China and how Kitty and Lala put it all together.
Kitty and Lala went to university together, actually, and they just always had an interest in photography. Once they graduated, they were looking for some sort of project to do together, and they were looking at wedding photos that were being made in China at the time and thought that they could do better. So they just started this kind of really grassroots campaign of making wedding photos. I think they were doing stuff for free at first just to try to, you know, get a bit of practice and get their name and their brand out. And then pretty quickly, they became really popular.
Do Kitty and Lala split their duties?
When they first started, Kitty was doing all the makeup and the costumes, and Lala was the photographer. He was doing the technical side of things. So they now have a bunch of photographers and makeup artists, so their role is just more managing the business, guiding the creative side of it.
What caused the change in attitude and popularity for this kind of photography?
It's just something that speaks to younger generations. Previously, like, the standard of wedding photo was two people, husband and wife, standing in front of a plain background. I mean, it was very, very kind of stiff. And I think their style just speaks to this younger group, younger crowd of people who are now starting to realize that they have a voice. They have people out there with similar ideas. You know, there's a lot of young people in China that are kind of looking for something that's different from what their parents knew or experienced. So I think that they're riding on that wave of just change, really.
A change in photo backgrounds helped popularize their work tremendously. How did they come up with that?
Wedding photos in China are a big thing. It's like one of the most important parts of getting married. And most couples will get their photos done before the actual celebration. And these photos, once they're taken, they're put up in the bedrooms of the couples in the centerpiece kind of a thing. So it is a big deal. And I think for a lot of young couples who are wanting to get married, you know, like the stuff that Kitty and Lala were doing, which is fun and vibrant and kooky and weird, I mean, it's just kind of more interesting, you know. And so, yeah, I mean, obviously, it's not just a change in the background. It's just a change of a way of thinking, I guess.
When did Kitty and Lala's success abroad begin? And how strong is the response from other Asian countries and beyond?
Kitty and Lala became quite successful very quickly, and over the last 2 to 3 years now, I think their business is still growing. I think certainly the style that they are doing, you know, you see a similar style in Korean wedding photos in other parts of Asia. Even in Australia, in Melbourne, we see the same kind of fun wedding photos taken. But yeah, I think they're doing stuff now, like they're taking couples abroad, making these kind of like travel packages where instead of just getting your photos taken locally, they're putting together this big production. You get to go to Hawaii, you know, make a little music video and get the photos taken. And again, yeah, young Chinese couples, if they have the money, like a dream come true.
Director Cho Lee uses a fast-paced style and exquisite use of split-screen cutting to make Kitty and Lala a dazzling film to watch. Individuality and the evolution in technology are what propels this successful new direction taken by the two extremely talented wedding photographers. Lee's own artistic visual flair in telling their story shows he is very much a part of that creative talent pool as well. I'm Ray Kugel.
And Ray tells us if you'd like to see the film, all you have to do is go to your favorite search engine and type in Kitty and Lala. I'm going to type in Steve and Norman. Let's see what we get. The latest world news. It's up next with Steve Norman and International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
For listeners in China, there's a new Chinese language iPhone application from VOA. Simply go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA space Chinese, and then look for VOA News Chinese Edition. With this application, you can get the latest news and radio and TV programs in Chinese. It also lets you transfer photos and video directly to Washington. Go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA Chinese to get your free Chinese language iPhone app from VOA.